Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This podcast is for mature audiences. It contains graphic violence and adult themes. Listener discretion is advised.
Realm presents Blood and Gold, starring Richard Cabral. Episode 13. 1853, El Dorado County, California. United States colonial ambitions extend far beyond North American borders. Commodore Matthew Perry and four U.S. Navy ships visit Japan, forcing them to open up to American trade and end centuries of isolation.
Worried about possible pursuit, we once again steered clear of Arroyo de Cantua until we knew we were in the clear. Instead, we traveled north and east into El Dorado County and the foothills of the Sierra Madre. One night we arrived at the remote ranch of a contact named El Fuego Torreon, who fed us beef from his own stock. He also brought us the news that had been sent through the Mexican grapevine.
Sheriff Marshall is on your trail, maybe 2 days behind. Not surprising, 13 men and 15 horses leave an easy trail. People are saying he's not just following your tracks. He's torturing Mexicanos to find out if anybody knows where you are.
Torturing?
Yes. He and some of the other men have beaten men, choked them, cut them, made them stand naked in the cold. I heard a few have even raped women in front of their men, or began to, unless the men said what they knew.
The news tore at my insides. I had thought myself steeled against any new outrages from California's white community. But this was a new low.
And have those men told them anything useful? Hard to say. What seems minor or obvious to us might be helpful to the law. Any little fact they can learn could help them find you.
Tres Dedos turned to me.
So we have to make sure we can't be found. Avoid our usual spots.
Yes. I'm sorry we came here, El Fuego. I hope we haven't brought you trouble.
There's nothing they can do to me that hasn't already been done.
One look at Torrejon proved the truth of that. He was perhaps in his mid-40s, but looked decades older. His dark hair streaked with silver, shoulders stooped from a lifetime's hard labor.
I have no woman for them to threaten, and my ranch hands would fight like wolves if they came near me.
The mention of wolves gave me an idea. Bear Mountain had changed little since my last visit. It was far enough from any settlements that people seldom visited. No gold had been found there, and the presence of the numerous bears, wolves, and other wild predators helped dissuade the merely curious. The cavern below the summit would offer safe refuge for my men, and the rocky slopes would make tracking difficult. If we took care to cover our back trail, finding us would be close to impossible. We took care to cover our back trail. After circling around the base of the mountain and climbing about a third of the way up, we dismounted, left the horses in the care of one man, and walked back over our own tracks for an hour. From that point, we worked to restore the land to the condition it had been in, brushing away hoof prints, straightening branches, replacing upturned stones and the like. We kept disguising our tracks until we reached the horses again. Hours had passed during which we hadn't put any distance between ourselves and the posse, but we hoped the posse would lose our trail altogether at that point. We continued up the mountain to the cave. From there, we could see the posse's approach and follow their progress once they reached the spot where we had covered our tracks. The posse arrived late that afternoon. I watched through a spyglass as their trackers climbed down from their mounts and studied the ground. They started off on foot this way and that, but couldn't find a clear trail in any direction. Their confusion lifted my spirits. When the sun sank behind the mountains and they still hadn't found the trail, the posse members pitched tents and lit a small fire for cooking. Marshall was there, all right. A thin man, brown-haired, with no mustache. He didn't look like a dangerous type. I had seen him a time or two in his mining days, before he was a sheriff, and never had a problem with him. But I had a problem with him now. Standing near the sheriff was another man who looked familiar, though it was hard to be certain through the little telescope, but he wore the sky blue of the American Army, and I believed him to be the man who nearly shot me back at Garland's draw. Muy bien, hombres. Time to go back down the mountain. Those fellows are in for a surprise. We were in no hurry. Making one's way down Bear Mountain on foot was a dangerous pursuit, especially if one took foolish chances. The moon was just a sliver behind high, wispy clouds, and it had risen in the mid-afternoon, so would soon be gone altogether. With me leading the way down game trails I knew, we moved cautiously and quietly, helping one another through the difficult stretches. We wanted to give the posse time to eat, perhaps drink some liquor, and fall asleep. As we neared the camp, we slowed even more. The posse had surely posted guards, and it wouldn't do to alert them. Finally, we were close enough to look down upon the camp. Some men slept in the open, others in tents. I turned to Tres Dedos, at my side as always. You see any guards awake?
I see one sleeping at his post.
Tres Dedos pointed out a man sitting upright with a rifle in his hands, but with his chin against a chest that rose and fell in slumber.
I'd post more than one, if it was me.
I let my gaze travel across the camp and its surroundings until it landed on a man walking toward the camp, adjusting his pants.
There, he was pissing.
That's decent of him. I hate it when a man can't bring himself to walk far enough away that the smell doesn't drift back before he does.
Don't admire him too much to kill him.
Never.
So, two? Any more?
There.
Tres Dedos tapped my arm and pointed to a man lying down, but rolling and twitching in obvious discomfort.
He's no guard, but he's not sleeping soundly, that's for sure. Stomach troubles, maybe. Smells like they had vulture for dinner. Or skunk. Something that shouldn't be eaten anyway.
I kept studying the layout. I'd heard there were 32 men at the outset, but rumor had it that some already had dropped out and headed home. I couldn't get a definite count, with some concealed by tents. But with my spyglass earlier, I had counted 14. and I had 13. Not only were the numbers close, but I had the advantage of surprise and elevation. And my men were wide awake. I gathered them around me and pointed out the camp, the tents, the fire, and the guards. The one who just returned had found the sleeping one and shaken him by the shoulder, rousing him. Too awake for sure. That one on the ground who might or might not be sleeping. No way to know the status of anyone in the tents. The guards moved away from the fire and took a position on opposite sides of the camp, looking outward. Every few minutes, they got up and moved around, keeping themselves alert and sweeping the whole perimeter. They'd chosen a good spot to make camp. Most of it was ringed by large rocks that would block the wind and could provide cover in a fight. Their horses were picketed a short distance away within sight of the camp. I outlined my plan, and the men nodded their agreement. At my direction, some of the biggest of them put their backs to a massive boulder well-rooted in the mountainside. Heaving and grunting, they pushed and pushed until it finally broke free from its resting place. Loose dirt cascaded down the slope, and I worried it might alert the posse below. If any fell that far, nobody reacted in a way that I could see. Then the men stopped, with Florencio Cruz and Antonio Moreno straining to hold the big stone from underneath.
Are we ready, Joaquin?
I took a quick, last look at the path. Let it go. Cruz and Moreno moved. At the same moment, the men holding the stone from above released it as well. It toppled from where it had rested for what might have been decades or centuries. On the way down, it struck the mountainside a couple of times, breaking other lesser rocks free. The noise was thunderous to us and to the men camped below. Screams of terror reached my ears. I leaned far over for a better view and almost slipped, but Gustavo Zaragoza caught my waistband and held on. The boulder crashed to the earth in the center of the camp, accompanied by a storm of smaller stones. I couldn't see how many men were killed instantly, though some certainly were. Others scrambled away from the rain of stones.
Muy bien, hombres. Pick your targets and let's go.
I selected a man who'd been hit by a good-sized rock and was stumbling around senselessly, bleeding from the scalp, and I fired my revolver. The range wasn't ideal, but I was shooting almost straight down, so the bullet would strike with plenty of force. My first shot missed, but I hit the man on the fourth try. The others were all shooting by then too, and most of the posse members who'd escaped the initial landslide had fallen. Some, though, had escaped both and were trying to return fire. After several minutes, no more shots came from below, and I could no longer see movement from the camp. I led us back to a game trail I knew. We passed through a rising cloud of dust to arrive at the scene of the carnage. Dead and dying Americans were everywhere. One beside the fire, face down. Another with his lower half sticking out of a bloody tent flap. Two who never made it out of their bedrolls. Parts of what might have been several different people showed at the edges of the great boulder. I didn't see Marshall anywhere. As the odor of burnt powder cleared, I smelled piss and shit, blood and vomit and sweat, the scent of men under fire. Only two of the bodies wore badges. Most of these men were merchants, miners, farmers, husbands and fathers, not deputies. They'd been conscripted or volunteered for a task to which they were unsuited, and they paid the highest price. Inside a tent, someone whimpered in obvious agony. I bent over, stuck my head and arm inside the tent, and ended a young man's pain with one shot. I went from there to another tent on the eastern edge and saw a slash at the back of it. The occupants had cut their way out and ran out into the night. Tres Dedos walked up to me.
I count 10. Hard to tell how many are under the rock, though.
Mota, count.
Mota nodded and raced around the camp, poking his head into the tents and kicking at bunched blankets.
Yes. So 4 escaped, if my original count was right. 4, more or less. Do you want to try to find them now? Could be dangerous in the dark.
I knew that to Tres Dedos, danger wasn't a drawback. It was an attraction.
No, let's get some rest and wait until dawn. They could get pretty far by then. They won't. They don't know where they are or what they're facing. And besides, they're on my mountain.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for 2 women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it. Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
The only wounded among us was Gregorio Lopez, who had a scrape on his right cheek. Not from a bullet or a rifle ball, but from rock fragments thrown up by a bullet hitting stone. My men gathered up the posse's weapons and ammunition. We deposited those near the horses. I posted 3 guards, and the rest of us settled down to sleep until daybreak. We didn't bury the bodies. Once we left, wolves and coyotes and possibly bears would move in. Nature could deal with the mess. When the sun rose, we scoured the edge of the camp for signs of the men who'd escaped through the tent wall. Finding some broken branches, along with prints from a few different boots, I put a man in charge of watching the extra horses we just acquired, while the rest of us mounted up and set off in pursuit. I wasn't worried about losing the surviving members of the posse. Even if the men made it off the mountain, they were on foot and we had their horses. For the first stretch, all 4 pair of boots went in the same general direction. But then, 2 pairs had taken a game trail that led farther up the mountain, and the other two had seemingly missed the trail in the dark and continued in a more or less straight line, cutting through the thick underbrush. Mota, who was the best tracker among us, turned to me.
Should we split up?
No. That trail is only going to take those men higher up, so we'll have more time to catch up to them. Let's stay with these two for now. After another mile or so, the line the two men took intersected into another game trail. They had taken this one, turning downslope to get off the mountain. The men had made no effort to hide their tracks. In less than an hour, Bolvia caught a glimpse of them and pointed them out to the rest of us. Only one wore a hat, a dusty black bowler. The other one was bareheaded and had a long gun resting on his shoulder. Lopez volunteered to kill them from where he stood. He was perhaps marksman enough to do it, but the distance was still great.
Cerquémonos. I want to see if one of them is that sheriff.
The two Americans soon realized they were being followed. They took off at a run. I put my heels to the horses and sped up to a trot. The men on foot reached a level spot with rocky soil, sparse vegetation, and a few large boulders that had fallen from the height over the centuries. They ducked behind one of the largest of the fallen boulders. The one with the long gun loaded it quickly and rested it on the boulder. He aimed and fired, but in his rush, he shot high, his ball soaring far over our heads. The other man had a revolver, which he fired several times. Two of his shots hit Tres Dedos' horse. The animal stumbled and fell, pitching Tres Dedos into the dirt.
Maldita sea! Not another horse!
He rose and dusted himself off. His face was bloody from scraping against the earth. He stormed toward the rock, seemingly oblivious to the fact that the men still had guns.
Son míos! They're mine! Cousin, espera! You men, throw down those guns. You have no chance against all of us.
The bareheaded one did the talking.
What kind of chance do we got without him?
A fair question. But the truth is, you men aren't very good shots. And you've made my friend very angry. At this point, I suspect he'd take both of you at once. Without any guns. Is that right, Jack? I rarely used the name that the Americans had given to Tres Dedos, but it had the desired effect. The men's eyes widened and their mouths dropped open. They were being asked to confront the dreaded three-finger Jack. 2-1, but with no firearms in play.
Look, I ain't no fighting man. I came out here to work the diggings. I went bust, and now I work in the store. I ain't never hurt nobody.
But you were willing to kill us, if you could have.
You killed a bunch of Americans, took their gold.
So, to punish killing, you would kill others?
An eye for an eye, it's in the Bible.
Then if you would kill us, what's wrong with us killing you? By now, Tres Dedos was almost upon them. They hadn't given up their guns or come out from behind the big rock. Every few seconds, the one in the hat looked over at Tres Dedos like he was some demon from hell.
I just look, I don't want no trouble.
The man in the bowler still hadn't spoken.
You were just shooting at us, and your friend killed my friend's horse. There has to be some kind of payback, don't you think?
The bareheaded one snatched the revolver from the other man's grip and threw it toward the outlaws.
He's the one that shot the horse. I only fired the one shot over your heads, like to scare you is all. You want to fight somebody? Fight him.
The look of rage on the other man's face was almost comical.
Charlie, what the hell are you doing? I'm just saying, you're the one who shot the fattest horse. Anybody got an answer for that? I mean, sure, but you. Damn you, Charlie. You lily-livered son of a...
Gentlemen, that was an interesting choice you made, Charlie. But that's not the decision you face right now. the only decision you have is 2 against 1 or 11 against 2. And I assure you, unlike my friend, Three-Fingered Jack, we won't hesitate to use our guns. The only reason you're not dead yet is that Jack wants to do it himself. Charlie and the man in the bowler faced each other, fear and fury warring within them both. Finally, Bowler nodded, and Charlie did the same.
2 against 1?
Are you sure?
We beat him? What happens?
If you beat him, we give you 2 horses and send you on your way.
Honest?
Yes. But you won't beat him.
We'll die trying.
That's exactly what you'll do.
Tres Dedos took off his sarape and his sombrero and handed them to Lopez. He removed 2 pistols from his belt and handed those over as well. For their part, Charlie and the man in the bowler followed through on their agreement. Charlie tossed his rifle down, and both men stepped out from behind the rock. Without being told to, my men spread out, making a circle around the combatants. Tres Dedos paused briefly and looked up at me, his anger undiminished.
When this is over, if I'm dead, let those men live.
That's the agreement.
But before you send them on their way, cut off their balls.
He let out a low growl, sounding more like an angry bear than a human being, and charged Bowler. That man had stayed largely quiet throughout the confrontation, so although I knew Charlie's name and story, I knew nothing of the other's background. The man met Tres Dedos charged with feet planted, widespread, giving him balance and stability. As Tres Dedos neared him, he threw an awkward punch while still on the move. Bowler dodged it easily and let Tres Dedos' forward momentum carry him too close to throw another. He grabbed Tres Dedos' outflung arm and yanked on it. Off balance, Tres Dedos stumbled, and Bowler slammed the knee into his chest. Air blew out of him in a huff. Bowler pressed his advantage. He lashed out with his fist, landing a flurry of blows against Tres Dedos' face and neck, staggering him. Charlie joined in, positioning himself behind Tres Dedos and kicking, his boot crashing into Tres Dedos' lower back. When Tres Dedos whipped his head around to see this new assailant, Bowler doubled his fists together and swung them into Tres Dedos' jaw. For the first time, I considered the possibility that my friend might lose. Against Charlie alone, Tres Dedos would already be done, wiping his hands of the other man's blood. But the man in the bowler hat proved to be a challenge of a more serious nature. Already, blood flowed from Tres Dedos' nose and mouth like water from a pump. He looked dizzy, reeling as he fought for balance. Then, Bowler made his first mistake. Apparently, believing Tres Dedos already beaten, he wrapped his hands around Tres Dedos' throat and started to squeeze. But Tres Dedos managed to lower his head and bit down on Bowler's forearm. Bowler screamed as the teeth sunk in and tore. After a moment, Tres Dedos whipped his head up again, a chunk of bloody flesh clenched between his teeth. He spat it in Bowler's face, and Bowler released Tres Dedos' throat. Tres Dedos roared up and lunged at him. Now the advantage was his. Bowler's ruined arm gushed blood, his face paled, and he was unsteady on his feet. When Tres Dedos plowed into him, he went down. Tres Dedos straddled him and rained punches down, pulping Bowler's face. Bowler writhed under the attack, but the fight had gone out of him. When Tres Dedos realized his opponent was no longer striking back, he gripped Bowler's throat, pressing his thumbs against either side of his windpipe. Bowler fought for breath, his feet kicking, but after a few minutes, he was still. Tres Dedos rose quickly, smashed a boot against Bowler's face for good measure, and looked for the second man. But Charlie had curled up in a ball, sobbing, his back against the boulder like he wanted to sink into it. When Tres Dedos took a step toward him, Charlie let out a panic cry. I didn't really blame him. Tres Dedos looked more monster than man, blood-soaked, barrel chest heaving, face a rictus of rage and bloodlust. Surprisingly, instead of attacking, Tres Dedos went to one knee beside Charlie. He spoke in quiet, calm tones.
I have to do this, but I'll make it fast. All right? It won't hurt.
Charlie tried to answer, but he could only sputter. He nodded his head, then tilted it back and looked at the sky. As if beseeching the heavens to intercede, Tres Dedos reached up his sleeve and brought out a long-bladed knife. With a smooth, swift motion, he drew it across Charlie's exposed neck. Blood jetted from the wound, splashing Tres Dedos and the dirt beneath him in more or less equal measures. Charlie's body spasmed a few times, each one spraying out more blood, his boots rapping against the earth like a dancer at a fandango. And then he slumped over sideways. The flow of blood from the gaping wound at his neck slowed to a trickle. Tres Dedos turned back to me. There seemed to be as much blood outside him as inside, but most of it belonged to his foes. When he grinned, showing blood-spattered teeth, one eye already swelling shut, the sight was horrifying. A wrong turn led the last two members of the posse into a box canyon. A spring high up on the far wall of the canyon dribbled water down the steep rock face, and where it landed, a small pool had formed. Observing them from above, my men and I heard them shouting and arguing with each other. One of them was Sheriff Marshall.
Water, sea roads, I knew we'd find some this way.
Those walls are pretty steep. I still don't like the idea of walking into some place where we don't know where we'll end up.
Now that I saw roads again, I knew for certain that he was the same ex-army officer who'd almost shot me during the raid on Garland's Draw. Marshall picked up his pace, eager to reach the pool.
Hell, we haven't known where we end up all damn day. Why is this any different?
I don't know. I just don't like the feel of it.
Listen here, I'm in charge of this outfit.
Not much of an outfit left, is it, Ben? Two of us. Two more may be alive, and maybe not. That was gunfire we heard earlier, after all.
From the sound of it, the men's nerves and tempers were frayed. Marshall reached the pool ahead of Rhodes, dropped to his belly, and plunged his head in. He splashed with his arms and drank deep. When Rhodes caught up, he laid down the rifle, dipped his canteen, filled it, and took a few big swallows. Distracted by their thirst and the tension between them, they remained unaware of me spying on them from atop of the canyon walls.
I'm glad we found water, Ben, but I don't like it here. There's no way out but the way we came in.
Marshall pointed to the rock wall on either side of where the spring water seeped down. The rocks were jagged.
A man could climb there. He had to.
Could, I reckon. Wouldn't be easy, though.
You in a hurry to leave?
Rhodes started to reply, but a noise behind them silenced him. He spun around to discover five more of my men coming for them, blocking the only way out of the canyon.
Ben, easy now. Don't start. We got company. Don't give them any reason to shoot.
Marshall scowled, sat up quickly, and turned around. When he saw the hostile Mexicans, his face blanched. Think we could climb the wall and get back shot? Back or front, don't make much difference.
Rhodes' rifle was on the ground. By the time he could draw his pistol, we could shoot. He glanced back at the wall again, perhaps thinking about risking the climb. And this time, he saw me and three others standing on top of it, looking down. I smiled at him.
That's good water, isn't it? Sometimes I drink from there. Other times there are too many animals, and the smell of their shit keeps me away. You're lucky it rained hard the other day. Wash some of it away.
Rhodes stood perfectly still, but Marshall's right hand inched toward the gun at his hip. I saw it and pointed a rifle at him. The other men around me did the same.
I wouldn't do that, Sheriff, unless you're reaching for the gun so you could drop it into the spring.
Actually, I had a mind to put a bullet in your head, mister.
Trying that would just get you killed. And if you fell into the water, you spoil it for those that depend on it. We can't have that. How about if you raise your hands and back away?
How about if you fuck your Mexican whole mother?
My smile vanished.
Ben,
that isn't very neighborly.
We ain't neighbors.
We are now. Only, you're in my neighborhood. You might have noticed that you're surrounded.
I did.
I would like you to drop your guns to the ground. Easy. Pluck them with two fingers and put them down where I can see them.
Or what?
Or you'll die where you stand.
You expect us to believe you won't kill us anyway.
That's not my goal. I want you to live. I want you to carry a message to the other lawmen around California and all who mistreat my people. The fact that Marshall and his men had tortured and terrorized innocent Mexicans while hunting me could not be forgotten or forgiven.
Fat chance I'll carry anything for you.
I think you will. The guns, please.
Best do as he says, Sheriff. They wanted us dead. We'd already be there.
Marshall hesitated, but ultimately he agreed. He pulled his pistol free with two fingers and dropped it onto the earth. Rhodes followed suit.
I'm coming down. Remember, if you go for those guns, you're both dead.
We get it. Whatever you got in mind, just get it done.
I climbed down beside the spring water, just where my prisoners had thought it might be possible to go up. Having done this before, I knew exactly where to put my feet. In moments, I was down where they were. My men on ground level behind them moved in closer, keeping their long guns trained on the two Americans. Rhodes scowled. I couldn't blame him for worrying about his chances. I walked up to Marshall. I was slightly taller than the sheriff, but not by much.
Take off your boots.
My boots?
Did you get water in your ears?
Yes, your boots.
Why should I?
Because I told you to. If you want to live another minute, take them off. Marshall grumbled, but he sat down in the dirt and pulled off his boots.
Now what?
This will hurt. I crouched beside the sheriff and took one stocking foot in my hand. Gripping it tightly, I snatched a knife from my belt and slashed the bottom of Marshall's foot before the other man could react. Marshall screamed and yanked his foot back, leaving a trail of blood on the ground.
Now the other one.
Are you fucking crazy?
Instead of answering, I grabbed the other foot and wrenched it toward me. I sliced that one too. Marshall screamed again. I released him and stood.
That's the message. You might be able to walk, but it'll hurt like hell. You might never walk right again. I don't know. I'll send men back with a horse for each of you. Canteens, bedrolls, everything you'll need to get home. And when you do, let all the lawmen know what happened. And let them know that any man who comes after me is going to regret it as long as he lives. Which might not be long at all.
Thank you. You're listening to Blood and Gold, starring Richard Cabral. Blood and Gold is a Realm production in association with Stryker Entertainment. Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that, as well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.
Blood and Gold stars Richard Cabral. Based on the novel Blood and Gold, The Legend of Joaquin Murrieta by Jeffrey J. Marriott and Peter Murrieta. Produced by Marco Palmieri, Fred Greenhalge, Kaylin West, and Haley Wagreich. Adapted for audio by Greg Cox. Directed by Fred Greenhalge. Executive produced by Molly Barton, Marcy Wiseman, Russell Binder, Peter Murrieta, Julian Yap, and Richard Cabral. Historical notes read by Elena Ray. Spanish dialogue translated by Alana Graham. Regional dialect coaching by Luis Armando Mercado Campos. Sound design by Eric Mooney. Mixing, mastering, and additional sound design by Rory O'Shea. Audio editing by Corey Barton. Original score by Juan Carlos Enriquez. Music supervision by Marcus Pagala. Production manager Alexis Latshaw. Production coordinator Angela Yee. Casting by Sunday Bowling and Meg Mormon. Cover art by Kendall Thomas. Executive in charge for Realm, Mary Asadolahi. Find more shows like Blood and Gold by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.